The views expressed in this podcast are solely our own. This information is provided for your convenience. It does not constitute legal advice, nor does it create an attorney-client relationship. Prior results do not guarantee similar outcomes. This is attorney advertising. Enjoy. Hi, welcome to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Konecki. I'm a partner at Morgan, Lewis & Bacchius in the International Trade and National Securities Practice Group. With me, as always, is my great friend, Brent Carlson of Red Flags Rising Solutions, LLC. Brent, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks, Mike. Great to be here and to discuss some important news that just broke today.
Exactly. So today is Monday, September 29th. We're recording this just after 6 p.m. U.S. Eastern. The big news was that around 8:30 a.m. this morning, the Commerce Department dropped a bit of a bomb on the trade compliance community. It was a bomb that was previewed for many months and that has been talked about for a long time. This is the so-called 50% rule for the BIS entity list that, generally speaking, is intended to automatically extend the entity list to affiliates of listed entities owned 50% or more by those listed entities. Now, there's a lot of speculation in the media, Brent, a lot of speculation in the trade community about, is this a good idea, a bad idea? What will it look like? How will it walk and talk? Brent, walk us through your first take on the rule, and then we'll take it from there.
Right. The rule extends automatic coverage of the entity list for any company that's on the entity list to any affiliate that it has 50% or more ownership of. This mimics what we've seen over on the OFAC side with their 50% rule. There's a lot of talk in terms of how this rule represents a big sea change. As you mentioned, it's been a bomb that's been dropped. But in certain ways, the risks have always been there. We can unpack that a bit. While everybody's focusing on, oh, we're going to have to go back and do this due diligence, actually the message from BIS is really, well, you should have been doing this due diligence on these subsidiaries and affiliates already anyway. It poses questions if you're complaining about it, why all the noise and why weren't you doing it before? I mean, there's a couple pieces here that's important to unpack.
Maybe before we get into the specific details of this, there's already been a bit of confusion, disbelief, maybe wishful thinking about the effective date of this interim final rule. You know, in the past, especially related to semiconductors and AI-related controls, the United States government has sometimes previewed what was coming and then was greatly disappointed, although maybe not totally surprised, that a lot of front-loading happens in advance of a rule that has been previewed coming into place. There were lots of reports about, for example, restricted memory chips getting stockpiled ahead of the effective date when they were trying to reduce those. On the other hand, when they announce something out of the blue, it makes it very difficult for trade compliance people to adapt. The government might say, well, that's exactly the point. We're not looking for adaptations, we're looking for things to stop. In this particular case, the interim rule is effective on the date of filing for public inspection. That's today. So Monday, September 29th, this rule is effective. There is a temporary general license, and we can talk about how limited it is, I think, and practical utility for people that could extend people another 60 days, but even after that, you're going to have to comply with this. There was some confusion today around the Bureau of Industry and Securities press release, which I think conflated that temporary general license's applicability with the effective date of the law, so people thought they'd have time. Look, it's always hard to adapt quickly to things like this. If you had not already been evaluating risks under the other catch-all provisions that might have existed because of an affiliation between a counterparty, between any party in a transaction, and a listed entity, then this is a big, significant change for you. I think many companies were already doing that because that is data that's available through a lot of the screening tools. There was some controversy not that long ago over whether or not it was really appropriate to just shift exports to a newly created affiliate, for example, of a listed entity. One perspective that I think is useful to level set expectations when you're talking about national security laws is that the government, for better or worse, doesn't consider these national security determinations to be open for discussion. They have their own internal processes for evaluating what those risks are and what they want to do about them. There's no defense, for example, to these rules for people who just don't agree. This isn't a matter of conscience or political advocacy for people. that may be what you have to do in order to get the national security determination changed, but you have to recognize that it's not a determination for anyone in the private sector to make. Secondly, your behavior will be judged by a government within which at least many people have considered these national security concerns to be valid and serious. It's really important when you're thinking about how do we adapt to this new rule, the actions you take will be evaluated through those eyes, the eyes of the government, not your own. One thing we should expect the government to say is, yes, this rule had immediate effect as of today, but this rule has been a matter of public discussion for months, going back to nomination hearings of senior BIS administration officials months ago. It's been the subject of multiple media reports. You and I, Brent, were quoted on September 2nd in Dow Jones Risk Journal on whether this changed anything or not and how this compared to other restrictions. So if people are hoping that there's some sympathy within the U.S. government, especially within the Bureau of Industry and Security, for how quickly this became effective, I think pleas for sympathy are going to fall on deaf ears. Brent, why don't you walk us through what's significant? What are some of the key aspects of this, especially those that might be not fully appreciated as people scramble to digest what actually became official today?
Absolutely. I've got three main points to cover. The first thing is it's important to note that the 50% itself is not a threshold below which risk goes away. Rather, it's quite the opposite. In fact, there's part in the rule where folks should pay particular attention to. And I'll just read the quote here. BIS is also informing the public that foreign parties with significant minority ownership by or other significant ties to, e.g. overlapping board membership or other indicia of control, an entity-list entity, an NEU-list entity, or an SDN subject to Section 744.8A, present a red flag of potential diversion risk to the listed entity. So, just to recap, what that means, if there is an affiliate that's below that 50%, that still represents a red flag, and BIS says it clearly, they are informing the public that this is a red flag. So keep that in mind in all this. That 50% threshold is not a magical cutoff below which everything is going to be just fine.
Why isn't it? Why are they talking about informing the public here? Well, they're talking about informing the public because they're really talking about knowledge. While they point out that this is a strict liability rule, the enforcement determination, the penalty determination, will be influenced by whether they think you had knowledge that there was behind the scenes some 50% or more ownership. They also point out that the rest of the EAR apply. You're absolutely right to point out that the entire ballgame is not just to find a way under 50%. If you do that, one, you're exposing yourself maybe to some second guessing with hindsight from the regulators, but two, you're not even maybe halfway there when you think about all the other potential ways that the government might view risks and high probability awareness in such a scenario.
Another aspect in all this too is that people have referred to this new rule as closing a loophole, but actually there really wasn't a loophole here. If you have a customer that goes onto the entity list and then business gets shifted over to another affiliate, when that happens, that's not a loophole. That can be a major liability pitfall. And that's the subject of an article that kicked off our Fresh Look series in NYU Law School's program on corporate compliance and enforcement blog, with that article that's titled "When Loopholes Create Liability Pitfalls, a Fresh Look at Export Controls." We'll link that article and other stuff in our podcast notes. But it's important to take a look at that, and especially look at things from a white-collar perspective, because if the fact patterns show that business was shifted to an affiliate right after a customer went on the entity list, that poses significant liability pitfalls that should really need to be addressed.
And in that context, Brent, you hear a lot of concern from industry about the difficulty of doing this. You're going to be put in a position by the government to prove the negative. In that type of context, they're going to consider, fairly or not, the burden to have shifted to you. Explain to us what due diligence you did to get yourself comfortable that there was not an awareness of a high probability of these issues. We see that, Brent, even at the end of the interim final rule, where they talk about the unique license application process, so that if you have an affiliate as a party to a transaction, they get listed because of their affiliation to the listed entity, you can't apply for a license. And interestingly, it doesn't say there's a presumption of denial specifically in this context. I think in a lot of the underlying context in which the original listings happened, you would have such a presumption, and I think you should assume that will flow down. But they don't put that here. In the license application, they expect you to describe what due diligence you did that led you, especially in the context where you can't prove up 100% of the ownership, what did you do exactly to try to find that? In that context, the government is not going to feel that relying only on an end user certificate is sufficient. If you look back at America's AI Action Plan, one of the policies adopted in that plan by the administration is to better partner the Commerce Department with the intelligence community. Companies are going to be in a dangerous place where the government is likely to have more information than they do, and different parts of government are likely to be better coordinated regarding that information than they might have been in the past.
Good points. The third main point I wanted to make was that this new rule likely will trigger more enforcement actions in a couple of ways. So first, there are going to be some parties out there that are going to attempt to smurf. That's an old term from the cartoon characters, the short little people, meaning they're going to try to shift to an entity that's below that 50% threshold. So you might see new entities popping up at 49% or below. But that quote, that excerpt that I mentioned earlier, that addresses that issue right up front. So that's probably not going to fly, but there's always folks out there who don't get the memo and might try to do it anyway. Second, in applying for licenses for affiliated entities, the timing of when exporters engage in transactions with the entity list affiliates will be important. And this kind of goes back to that article again, when loopholes create liability pitfalls. If transactions jump right after the original customer went on the entity list, then that's a red flag of diversion. That's something where we talk about that in an example in that NYU PCC article. That's also something that companies should really be careful on and check. If the facts do align with that particular type of pattern, that's something they jump on right away, because certainly enforcement activity is going to pick up what we've talked about with EIS leveraging the full definition of knowledge under the VAR combined with General Prohibition 10. They're going to be able to bring more cases, resolve them faster, with substantially higher penalties.
Oh, well said, Brent. And look, there's a lot of attention being paid right now. There's almost, frankly, a panic from some of the conversations I've been a part of just in the last less than 12 hours, just under 10 hours at this point, focused on this can't be serious, right? They're like, what do we do? This is exactly the type of situation where the most important thing to convey to your sales colleagues, to your stakeholders, is do not make a quick decision right now. Do not jump into the immediate solution. This is very deliberately a situation where there is not a quick workaround. This is a crisis moment for a lot of people as we're recording this. There are shipments that are blocked. There are things that are sitting on a pier, at an airport, in a warehouse, on a truck, and people aren't going to know what to do with it. Even if the topic had been previewed, no one really knows what it means until they can hold the pages in their hands. You know, Brent, I think you've hit the key points for sure, especially where the people might face the greatest pressure to make a decision they regret later. That's by far the most important thing that we can share our views about on this somewhat of an emergency podcast. A few other things just to note for people who may get questions about this. There is a temporary general license. It is of very limited usefulness. Its availability depends on the ultimate end destination for the items you're exporting, so you have to know that. If your ultimate end destination is in country A5 or A6, essentially a friendly country from a U.S. national security perspective, you should go ahead and apply because you'll likely get it. You only get 60 days to sort this out. If you're in a category E country, E1 or 2, like Iran, North Korea, Cuba, there's zero chance you'll get a license. If you're anywhere else in between, you can only get a license if it's for a joint venture that has an American partner or a partner in the A5 or A6 countries. That's everybody. That's from B all the way through to D. So China, Singapore, Malaysia, there's no availability of this temporary general license to those entities unless they're in a joint venture with an American entity or an A5 or A6 entity. We'll put links in the show notes to where people can quickly pull up that country list because it's extremely important under this. Brent, one thing that surprised me was this was not limited to the entity list. It also applies all of the same rules and principles to the military end user list, so MEU list, and it allows aggregation across those lists. So if you have 30% ownership by an entity list entity and 20% ownership by an MEU list entity, you are now a blocked affiliate under this rule. They also bring in ownership by designated parties by the Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control. So all three of those affiliations could aggregate up to 50%. Another thing that jumped out to me in going to the evasion point, Brent, or the anti-evasion purpose behind this, over and over and over and over again, the interim final rule talks about not only direct ownership, but indirect ownership. And it talks not only about the individual ownership by one listed entity, but as we were just talking about, the aggregated ownership. Those are both very deliberate aspects of this law intended to prevent simple evasion, quick evasion plans. So if you're sitting here listening to this and you're looking at an email from a customer saying, great news, we're going to interpose a Singaporean entity in the middle of this and we'll be fine. No, you won't be fine. And certainly remember also, the government is going to look at before and after trade data. And if you start to have different customers and shipping to different people on September 30th, they're going to want to know why.
Just to make a comment on that, it's actually related to your comments that you just made. You made the earlier suggestion of don't just jump to a reaction on this now that you've got companies that may be in crisis mode in terms of responding to it. And the reason for that is don't let people somewhere in the organization do exactly that, do exactly shift to another entity, do something like that. That would be a huge red flag for BIS to go look at. And that could expose the company through the collective knowledge doctrine that you talked about that would pose significant enforcement liabilities on them. Now that companies may be in crisis mode, don't just do a knee-jerk reaction based on old legacy behaviors or assumptions on how export controls work. A lot of people assume that this was okay, that this was a loophole that they could use in their export controls compliance program. It's not. Right now, it's going to be a very important time to think very carefully and strategically in terms of how companies are going to implement this new rule through their compliance organizations to avoid major enforcement pitfalls.
Brent, related to that, look, I think we always try to ascribe the best of intentions to people, or at least not malevolence to people or ill will. There were some bits and pieces of guidance out there that might have been overly interpreted or overly relied upon that maybe led people to think, well, maybe some of these legacy solutions are actually real solutions. There's a few changes that I think are very significant that BIS is making, not only in the rules, but to actually their guidance, which are also codified in the rules. One of which was that they used to rely on a principle called a legally distinct standard. Under that standard, they would look to see whether an affiliate was legally distinct from the entity listed affiliate or the MEU list affiliate. If it was a branch office, for example, of a listed entity, it was wrapped up in the listing. But if it was a legally distinct entity, it was not included by default, right? And if they wanted to add it, they'd have to go through an interagency process to add it. Now, that didn't mean that any other provision of the EAR couldn't also have applied. As we have been saying a few times now, you still should have been checking for potentially applicable end use and end user restrictions that turned on knowledge. But from the perspective of the entity list itself, their own guidance was that we're not going to extend it to that. So if you are overly focused on the entity list, just like some people I think are overly focused on item-based classifications, you might have misunderstood and thought that this was really what was driving the boat. I think a safer way to think about the entity list, even in the past, but especially now going forward, is that it's a shortcut for the due diligence the government's expecting you to do. They're doing it for you, for the entities that are listed, and now for the affiliates of those entities. But that doesn't mean there's not a due diligence obligation otherwise under other aspects of the EAR, especially when you're aware of red flags that there may be a prohibited end use or end user. This KYC guidance is at supplement number 3 to part 732 of the EAR. We've talked before, Brent, about how some very specific clauses in this could be dangerously cherry-picked to give a suggestion that there's not an obligation to look behind representations from counterparties or other parties in transaction to dig up red flags when they didn't otherwise reveal themselves. If you read the sentences before and after that clause, if you read the paragraphs immediately following the clause, it's clear that that's not what BIS is saying. You do need to take a risk-based approach to finding red flags. Well, in this case, BIS is specifically saying the application of this new affiliates rule, as they call it in the rule itself, creates an affirmative duty to determine the ownership of other parties to a transaction in order to comply. That's very unambiguous. There's a table that I think every compliance officer needs to get familiar with very quickly in the interim final rule. And sorry for the paper shuffling as I sort through this, as I'm sure people listening are probably doing that as well. They don't have page numbers in the PDF, unfortunately, but I've hand numbered it as page 27. Table one, compliance aid for understanding the application of the affiliates rule for the entity list, MEU list, and SDN designations. I recommend looking at third page, page 29 of the PDF, under a section about what do we do where there are foreign companies where we don't have knowledge, in quotes, because it's using a defined term under the EAR, that the foreign entity is owned by a listed entity. There they say exporters, re-exporters, and transferors, that's for in-country transfers, must adopt a risk-based compliance program to assist them in complying with these requirements. And they reiterate right above that, accordingly, exporters, re-exporters, and transferors have an affirmative responsibility to know the ownership of the foreign companies that are parties to a transaction. I think in many cases, this won't be that difficult. And I'm hoping for the sake of our listeners, it won't be that difficult. But what this rule is saying is that if for some reason it's difficult, that is a red flag that they expect you to do due diligence. Now, what happens when you can't figure it out? Brent, regarding this supplement number three to part 232, also known as BIS's Know Your Customer Guidance and Red Flags, they add a new red flag number 29. That says, when you have knowledge, in quotes, again, defined term to include an awareness of a high probability, that a foreign entity that is a party to the transaction has one or more owners that are listed on the entity list or the MEU list, or that they're unlisted entities that are themselves subject to license requirements or other restrictions based on their ownership. What does that mean? That means covered by this new rule. There's going to be a domino effect in terms of what you need to do. You have an affirmative duty to determine the percentage of ownership by those entities, and if that is not possible, to obtain a license from BIS if required under the entity list or the MEU list based on the requirements for the owner or owners of that foreign entity, unless an exception is available. At first read, including my own first read, I didn't really see reference to control. And if you look at the actual text of the proposed rules, for example, even for the due diligence of entities where there's less than a 50% ownership by listed entities, where they advise exporters, re-exporters, and transfers to act with caution and to do due diligence, there's not a mention there of control. But you pointed out, Brent, on page 8 of the PDF of the rule itself, in the preamble, where they're talking about why they're doing this, they say what, Brent?
Let me read that quote again. BIS is also informing the public that foreign parties with significant minority ownership by, and here's the key point, or other significant ties to, and they give examples, overlapping board membership or other indicia of control of an entity list entity, an MEU entity list entity, or an SDN subject to section 744.8A, represent a red flag of potential diversion risk to the listed entity. Again, this is something I think a lot of people will just read right through. They'll be focused on that 50% number. BIS is putting everybody on notice, even with a situation where there's minority ownership, if there are other significant ties in indicia of control, that presents a red flag of potential diversion to the listed entity. That's something to really pay attention to. Again, it goes back to that issue of don't do a knee-jerk reaction on this. If your company happens to be in crisis mode and responding to this, think about things carefully and strategically. And that will be the best way to keep business flowing and to avoid a lot of trouble.
Really important point, because you could see many people hoping that avoiding ownership but allowing those entities to maintain some form of control is an invited solution here. It's really not. It would be very dangerous to think that it might be. BIS doesn't make any promises that they're going to issue guidance beyond what's in this document, but they do say they might. And you could very easily see that being an area where they do feel a need later to issue guidance if they start seeing a lot of companies find creative ways to maintain control even without ownership, whether it's through board seats, frankly, whether it's through other means of political influence or control that do exist in other systems, whatever it might be, you could see that happening. And if people are worried now about trying to verify ownership through due diligence, that can be an even more difficult and less apparent means to exercise control. The best thing you can do is make sure that as best you can, you're controlling your own compliance exposure and your own risks through a risk-based compliance program that Brent includes, as we've often recommended, a high probability protocol that you can use to make and defend the inherently subjective decisions around these risks that you're going to have to make every day.
Absolutely.
Well, Brent, that brings us to managing up. On the day that the 50% rule was finally dropped by the U.S. government, what is your managing up?
Yeah, Mike, the world continuously moves on. Business models change. A business would not be successful going forward if it's based on an obsolete business model. Export controls compliance programs work the same way. Don't get caught in legacy assumptions on export controls where you think that, oh, there may be some loopholes there, but actually they turn out to be significant liability pitfalls. New challenges require new strategies to stay ahead of the game. Now is the time to act and do it thoughtfully and strategically.
Well, Brent, that concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. As always, be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well. And to everyone else out there, be well.